And thanks to all the other speakers so far. I think it's been a great session. I want to reflect first on kind of how Ken and I envisioned this session and how it is sort of filling out and working out, and that is as sort of an overview of the first issue again of this new subject matter area within environmental entomology. So a lot of the folks that we've heard from will be seeing in print again come February. And in that spirit, my talk is going to concentrate on kind of providing an overview of the article that I wrote along with Ken and with Aaron Adams, looking at symbiotic interactions with insects from an overall standpoint, and then specifically using bark beetles to provide some specific examples of aspects of symbiosis. So I'll start with definitions, which Ken covered earlier. I like this quote from Doug Zook, actually back in 1998, where he notes that even trying to define the term has become an act of verbal and often verbose masochism. And I myself, as I started to look at different concepts, wondered along with Jan Sapp, as Matt mentioned earlier, if we even need to define this thing at all. And have found it kind of ironic that the definition that I've settled on and that I've kind of talked Ken into as well, Doug Zook's definition, is even wordier than some of the original ones. But it is this notion that you've got organisms living together in a long-term intimacy with some development of either novel metabolism and or novel structures that maintain this relationship. So in our article, we will cover, and I'll talk briefly about some of these today, some of the major themes in symbiosis. Matt talked quite a bit about mutualism just now. Of course, there are examples of commensalism, even within the systems that he talked about, aspects of cooperation, and then even varying all the way into parasitism and pathology. Now, we choose in our article and in our research approach to focus on dendroctonous bark beetles as model systems for symbiosis for a couple of reasons. We have seen the development of some very complex, interesting structures on the part of the insects at least three times, probably much more than that, depending on your definition of a mycangium. We see this parallel evolution of symbionts, of micro and macro symbionts. We see these instances of cheaters, fungi that maybe have found a way into the symbiotic system without providing real benefits to the beetle. Or maybe they're just complementary symbionts. That's something that we still work on and still look at. And then finally, the diversity in life history that we see in these bark beetles, and of course, their very obvious effects on human values. So for example, with some of the dendroctonous and related bark beetles and their associations with fungi, you can see here, Matt already talked about, and I'll review briefly some of the aspects of the interaction between the southern pine beetle and its three main symbiotic fungi. There are other bark beetles as well that have varying degrees of associations with fungi with positive and negative effects on their development. As we look at these systems, the classic approach has usually been to look at the benefits first to the macro symbiont or the insect host, and some of these are pretty obvious and have been covered before. Aaron did a really nice job talking about some of the benefits of cellulose-degrading microorganisms to insects. But there are others as well, and we talk about this in the article. Some of these well-studied systems with aphids and their bacterial endosymbionts, the ectosymbionts associated with wood wasps, as Aaron talked about this morning, with the leaf-cutting ants, as Cameron described in the really nice work that he's done, and then finally, bark beetles, where we get into enzymes, which Matt didn't mention as much, but nitrogen as well. And we'll cover that in just a bit. There is also this notion of using your symbiont not so much as a direct benefit, but an indirect benefit in the sense of cofactors. As Nancy Beckage mentioned in her work with parasitic wasps and the virus they carry compromising the defenses of the tobacco hornworm as they colonize that host. And I would also mention the notion of bark beetle fungi as cofactors. Matt mentioned our understanding of Ophiostoma minus as being an antagonist. Well, that's really true at the point of larval development. But as we talk about context dependency and considering the time frame that you're looking at and the environmental conditions that you're looking at, really think that Ophiostoma minus might be considered a mutualist at an earlier stage in the beetle life cycle. For instance, as the beetle attempts to overcome host defenses, the bark beetle-associated fungus, Ophiostoma minus, the blue stain fungus, may serve as a cofactor, helping to compromise the defenses of the host tree and enable the beetle to colonize it. We also talk about in the article, we give more examples than this, but I'll just give a few here briefly. Protection from natural enemies, or at least interactions with natural enemies. There's the example of Pederis beetles. These are rove beetles in which females which possess the bacterial endosymbiont are able to coat their eggs with a protective toxin which protects the eggs from predation. Asymbiotic females are not able to protect their eggs in that way. And then bark beetles and parasitoid wasps as their natural enemies, which may in some cases use fungal odors to help locate their beetle hosts, and in other cases there may be odors from beetle symbionts which are actually repellent to the parasitoids. And then of course there are many others, and in some respects the study of these types of effects are much more advanced even than what we've been able to pull off so far in the bark beetles. The Wolbachia system, which unfortunately we were not able to hear about today, but there will be a nice article on that in the February issue of Environmental Entomology. And then within bark beetles, looking at nutritional effects and even assistance in the production of pheromones. The benefits to the microsymbionts are fairly obvious if we look in particular at the bark beetle system, where we have this mycangium, this specialized fungus-carrying structure, which provides shelter and transport and nutrition for the beetle-associated fungi, and I'll cover that in some detail today. So if we look at these complex associations, which Matt talked about in terms of the evolution of pestilence, and some context dependency has been mentioned earlier today as we look at some of these systems and the notion of having to look at net effects, we'll consider today to provide some real specific examples. The southern pine beetle, I'll talk a little bit about some work that was done in Ken Raffa's lab by Yasmin Cardoza on the spruce beetle, and then some work that really has not gotten beyond the point, as Matt mentioned, of a nice little life history story, which is pretty cool, but we actually need some data on. So you'll start to recognize some pictures and some slides and probably some conclusions from Matt's talk, but that's the hazard of working that closely with a guy for that long, as I have. This is the southern pine beetle, Dendroctonus frontalis, flying through the air. Attacks trees, and this is the part where the O-minus, the blue stain fungus, might help to serve as a mutualist for the beetle. As they attack the trees, you see this copious resin flow coming from the trees, and it's really in their best interest to exhaust this resin flow as quickly as possible and overcome the host defense. And if they don't have the fungus there, if there are enough beetles that all the beetles can do it on their own, they don't need that blue stain fungus around. But in less than those numbers, they need the fungus there to help exhaust the host defenses. And Francois Loutier has done some really nice writing on that topic. And you've seen this as well, the range of southern pine beetle, the drastic fluctuations that it undergoes, from small spots to huge acreages. This is on the Cherokee National Forest in Tennessee. Matt talked as well about the mite interaction, so I won't cover that much here. Here's another nice shot of a mite feeding on the parathecia of Ophiostoma minus. And you'll see this diagram, and I'll run through this quickly, with the Tarsonemus mites feeding on the Ophiostoma minus, carrying it around as they hitch a ride from tree to tree on the backs of southern pine beetles. Negative interactions between the blue stain fungus and the mycangial fungi, which are the mutualists to the beetle, and I'll talk about that in just a bit. The positive interactions between the beetle and the fungus, and then the negative interactions, obviously, between the beetle and the tree, but the nutrition that the tree provides for the beetle. Ophiostoma minus, even if it does help the beetle kill the tree initially, at the time of larval development, when you see these big patches of blue stain, you're not going to get much beetle development. And that's because of the growth of these mycangial fungi and their importance to the beetles. It's kind of a collar-like structure, as Matt indicated there, and I'll show you some more details of it, but the openings being right here at the front of the collar on the female, and this nice luxuriant growth of fungi for the beetle to feed on. And let's take a little bit closer look at this Meikangium. These are some really nice shots taken by our colleague Chet Musir at Mississippi State. Here's the collar-like structure. The head would be up here, the back of the body there. So we've ripped off the collar and kind of broken it into a quarter and made a section of it. If we blow up and look at it closer, you can see within this collar-like apparatus, this nice tube of fungal spores contained within there. There are gland cells on the outside of this Meikangium which produce some substances that probably nourish the fungus. But we still didn't really know exactly what was going on within this Meikangium, and I'll talk about some work we've done that might help to elucidate that a little bit. So these are the fungi we're dealing with, the blue stain fungus, which at the time of larval development is the bad guy, if you will, and the nutritional mutualists here. And we can see that the nutritional mutualist, especially this animal Curtisium species, do a great job of concentrating nitrogen more so than the blue stain fungus does. We can also see some cellulolytic activity on the part of the blue stain fungus here. And again, this will look familiar to any of you that saw Aaron's talk this morning. Wherever you see a white space, there's no cellulose left. And so you can see where this basidiomycete fungus has digested the cellulose within this media. And so we did some work looking at competitive interactions between these fungi, the animal Curtisium species versus the blue stain fungus, the Ceratocystiopsis versus the blue stain fungus. And you can see, even though the blue stain fungus grows very fast and colonizes this available substrate, the animal Curtisium can hang on to that little bit of territory that it has and protect it from the blue stain, whereas the Ceratocystiopsis just gets overwhelmed and loses that territory. So this might be a cheater of sorts, if you will. We looked at some of the mechanisms behind this, and it does look, for example, like the melanin that's produced by Ophiostoma minus in great quantities, that's where it gets the black or blue color, is inhibitory to the growth of the animal Curtisium species, not so much to the, or very much more so to the ranunculosum. And another part of this interaction comes with the introduction of Cameron Curry to this work. And his experience, which you heard about earlier today, in working with actinomycete bacteria and their interactions with leaf-cutting ants. And this all got summarized in a really nice paper came out in Science about a month ago or so, led by Cameron's student, Jared Scott, looking again at our southern pine beetle and the Meikangium on the female, looking more closely at it and starting to really zoom in on what we're seeing here, this matrix of substance that contains the spores, and wondering where this liquid matrix was coming from. And that's where Cameron started to spot what he thought looked suspiciously like these actinomycete bacteria growing along the edge of the Meikangium in these ropey-like filamentous structures. And in the galleries of the southern pine beetle, here's a larva feeding on fungal growth. But overlaying all of this fungal growth are filaments of these actinomycete bacteria. You can see really nicely in here what's going on. So you've seen where these might fall out in relation to other actinomycete bacteria, and here's the really vital work, the cool stuff out of this. Our actinomycete bacterium in competition with the animal Curtisium species, you can see a little bit of inhibition of the growth of this mutualistic fungus, but nothing compared to what you see in terms of the inhibition of the blue stain fungus, which is antagonistic to the larva. And this is the molecule that's responsible for this, a novel antibiotic with the super cool name of Meikangiomycin. I wish I would have come up with that, but I didn't. That's nice. And a graph indicating the differential effects of this. So really knocking down the Ophiostoma minus much more so than the mutualistic fungus. And here's a very nice diagram kind of summarizing what goes on within the gallery system of southern pine beetle, with the beetle ovipositing, the larvae trying to feed on the beneficial fungus, beneficial bacteria in there, inhibiting the growth of the antagonistic fungi, which are carried by the mites, and not inhibiting the growth of the mutualistic fungus. So another role for bacterium here in terms of protecting beetles from antagonistic fungi, this is found by Yasmin Cardoza, doing some work in Ken Raffa's lab, and I assigned her some really cool but probably pretty boring work on looking at the effects of resin acids on the growth of these fungi, and she wisely ignored that and started looking at what was actually going on in the galleries. I still have that data, Ken, and I need to publish it, by the way. I did that work, but Yasmin got to do the cool stuff, and I'm glad she did, because she found some curious behaviors and phenomena going on in spruce beetle galleries that were being invaded by these green fungi, Aspergillus fungi, Trichoderma fungi, going in and limiting gallery length of the beetle and killing the eggs of the beetle. She noticed that as these green fungi started to get closer and closer, the females started to get more and more agitated and actually just started puking all over the place in advance of these green fungi, smearing this around, and then noting that these bacteria in the ejections from the females were able to kill these antagonistic fungi. Since that time, looking at other systems, the work I just mentioned in Cameron's lab, the work that Yasmin did, and then some work that Aaron Adams has been doing in different systems, finding that this is a much more common phenomenon than we thought. So as if it wasn't already complicated enough with beetles and mites and fungi dependent in varying degrees on one another, we have to add bacteria into the mix, starting to interact with these systems and really controlling what's going on. Finally, we have the small southern pine engraver, and this again is one that some great work that John Moser and his technician Larry Roten did way back when. Just some very careful observational stuff that we really need to go ahead and get some real data out on and really start to define this a little bit better. But what we've got is the small southern pine engraver, Ipsivulsis. These are females of the beetle here with lots of little mites around their legs and up underneath the body. This beetle enjoys a mutualistic interaction with Basidium mycete fungus. Have never really found a mycangium in this beetle. There's been some presumption or assumption that the mycangium essentially is in the gut, that the beetle carries it in the gut, but even that has not really been demonstrated. But you can see areas where the larvae feed on these white fluffy growths of fungi. You can also see these little kind of semi-translucent, opaquish, balloon-like structures in there, and those are larvae of these mites, or rather, these are females of these mites. So these Elotoma bennetti mites, this is the female here, feeding on the same fungus the beetle feeds on. This is the mother mite here, here's another female there. The mother feeds on the fungus, and you can start to see the shapes within her. Those are developing eggs within the female. The eggs hatch, the offspring actually mate with each other within the female while they're still within the female, which I think presses the limits of parental tolerance of shenanigans. But once the female has had enough of that, she literally explodes, and out come baby little mites all ready to start the cycle all over again. So where do we take it from here? And again, I cover this a little bit more in the article and talk about some more proposed directions, but I think you can get plenty of ideas from what we've heard today as to what the next steps might be. It's been noticed that the study of symbiosis is quintessential systems biology, and I think this session today has really demonstrated that. It integrates all levels of biological analysis from molecular to ecological, and the interplay between organisms in the three domains of life. And where I think that we're really going to see the progress, and I'm the most excited about the future that we've got ahead of us, is where we start to marry the technical advances that we've made and the people that really know how to use these things with the holistic approaches that we've tried to take in the past to the natural history of these organisms. I've said for a long time that when I go to symbiosis meetings, I'm often jealous of the level of sophistication or reductionism, whatever you want to call it, that other systems have been able to apply to their study organisms, and I felt like we sort of lagged behind. I think we're catching up in a big way. Certainly I didn't do all this on my own. I'd like to acknowledge all the folks that were involved in this work, all the folks that I mentioned here, as well as folks like Diana Six, Jolie Mafu, who's my technician back in Pineville. And we are dedicating actually the review article in Symbiosis to Stan Barris, who passed away this last year, and Stan really did a lot of the early pioneering work on bark beetle fungi symbiosis. So thanks for listening, thanks for your time. Any questions? Yes.
Associated with our
Yeah, well, so Matt didn't get any questions before. Go ahead and answer that one. So we're talking about these are the Mexican pine beetle in Arizona, right? And in Mexico. So southern Arizona and in Mexico. And we're still working out the fungal associates there, but it seems like the blue stain fungi, O minus in particular, seem to be more absent from the system.
Seems to be there, but extremely rare.
There, but rare. Right. So the O minus is rarely found there, and where it is, it does not seem to be having the same sort of effects, but at any rate, the mites seem to be more dependent on the mycangial fungi than they are on the O minus. But we're still in the process of defining those species. Yeah. Right, and we don't know what's going on with the bacteria with Mexicanus. Yeah?
Any speculation on whether these bacteria toxify trees by other animals?
No. I don't have any speculation on that. It's certainly possible. They seem to be some pretty direct antibiotic effects in terms of these actinomycetes, although they're capable of degrading some cellulose and things like that as well. It's possible. The fungi themselves are actually decent at detoxifying some aspects of host chemistry, but nothing would surprise me at this point. Yeah?
Your choice of Doug's definition, do you think that fits with parasitic? I mean, when I think about the definition in the past,
Yeah, the question is whether or not Doug Zook's definition fits with parasitism. I don't know that it does terribly well, and I don't know that he would think it does, and I'm not real big on describing parasitism as symbiosis. I harbor no resentment against those who do, but if you'll note in the review article that we write, we don't really talk about it that much. I recognize that some people include it in that continuum, but I've always been a little bit more towards the mutualism side of symbiosis than the parasitism. And I don't want to call it straight out mutualism, that if it's not mutualism, it's not symbiosis. But parasitism to me seems to be such a special case as to earn its own definition, its own term. Yeah, that's why you say, why even bother defining it? But I don't know. I'm not aware of a lot of cases where the context dependency stretches all the way from out mutualism to parasitism. Varying degrees of benefits, yeah, to the point where maybe why even bother having it around, but maybe not all the way to parasitism. Even the case of O minus is not a case of parasitism or pathogenicity. It's more an indirect effect on mutualists. Yes, Matt.
Have you thought about if we were going to get to expand the lifeable variable bacteria?
Who we're going to get to what?
Expand the lifeable variable equation system to include the bacteria.
I was counting on you. You've always come through before. All right, thanks.